It's KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Coming up this hour, I'll talk with former U.S. Civil Rights Commissioner Mary Frances Berry about progress on civil rights, along with continuing racial challenges and economic inequality. Also, how did the last place Arizona Diamondbacks manage to sign a local TV contract worth more than $1 billion? I'll talk with writer Wendy Thurm, who covers sports business. Plus, we'll hear from Arizona's official balladeer Dolan Ellis and journalist Sam Lowe about their new book and CD project featuring stories about the state. We start today's program with the comments from Kayla Mueller's family that the U.S. government put policy in front of American citizens' lives by not doing more to get her freedom from her ISIS captors. Prescott residents Carl and Marsha Mueller spoke with NBC's Today Show.
How do you raise $6.2 million and pretty much made it impossible? But we feel they really did want to release Kayla.
During this time when Kayla was being held, the U.S. traded 5 Taliban prisoners for Bo Bergdahl.
That made the whole situation worse.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's when the demands got greater, they got larger, they realized that they had something.
And did you personally feel, why is that trade okay, but something similar is not okay for Kayla?
I actually asked the president that question when we were in the White House. Yeah, that was pretty hard, you know, to take.
And good morning, it's Here and Now on 91.5 KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Getting ready to talk with Paul Kinsinger, professor of business intelligence at the Thunderbird School at ASU and a former member of the U.S. intelligence community, about what the Mueller family had to say. And then coming up later on this hour, a reminder, I'll talk with former U.S. Civil Rights Commissioner Mary Frances Berry about progress on civil rights, along with continuing racial challenges and economic inequality. Also find out about from Arizona's official balladeer Dolan Ellis and journalist Sam Lowe about their new book. It's a CD project as well, featuring stories about the state. And also writer Wendy Thurm will talk about sports business in the context of the Arizona Diamondbacks, who had the worst record in Major League Baseball last year, and somehow they were able to get a more than $1 billion contract extension for their TV deal. Again, it's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein. Earlier this week, the Mueller family spoke on the Today Show and had some strong words to say about U.S. policy as it relates to dealing with terrorists and paying ransom. Coming up in just a moment or so, we'll talk with Paul Kinsinger, professor of business intelligence at the Thunderbird School at ASU. He's a former member of the U.S. intelligence community. Good to have you with us this morning on KJZZ's Here and Now. We'll take a very, very short break. We'll be right back with Paul Kinsinger here on 91.5. We apologize for these short technical difficulties. I'm Steve Goldstein. It's Here and Now on 91.5. For insight on what the Mueller family had to say earlier this week on the Today Show, we turn to Paul Kinsinger, professor of business intelligence at the Thunderbird School at ASU and a former member of the U.S. intelligence community. Paul, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. Good talking to you again.
So are the Muellers right when they say they think the U.S. put policy ahead of their daughter's life and the lives of others who may have been held hostage?
Well, having just watched the segment, I think, I understand their feelings as parents. Any parents would feel very closely to this, as they do. I've been in Washington in the early years of hostage taking back in the 80s, when I watched the U.S. government go through agony about this whole issue with regard to the hostages taken in Tehran, then in Lebanon in the early 80s, and so on and so forth, and all the contortions that the U.S. government went through at the time to try to get hostages back at almost any cost. And this ultimately culminated in what people will remember as the Iran-Contra fiasco, which was a giant effort to try to buy our hostages out of Lebanon through Iran on the grounds that the Iranians had some leverage to put on the hostage takers. And this, of course, blew up in the Reagan administration's face and nearly got President Reagan impeached. So ever since then, of course, our policy has been to not negotiate officially with hostage takers, not for for anything. Now, there obviously are situations where the U.S. government's going to do everything it can behind the scenes to try to talk to people who could have access to those who have taken Americans hostage. But the formal stance of not paying ransom, I think, is out there. And, you know, people may disagree with it, but it is it's the policy of administrations of both parties, frankly, that has been in place since pretty much the 1980s. And while I feel very much for the Muellers and for any parents of Americans who are out in dangerous areas, we also should remember as a population that of 320 million Americans, there are probably several hundred thousand at any given time that are in situations around the world where they are exposed to a variety of different potential risks. Unlike a lot of smaller nations or a lot of nations where there isn't, they're not generating as much travel, mm-hmm. Americans are everywhere around the world and in highly exposed positions. So, it's, you know, it's pretty risky.
Yeah, Paul, that's why, and this obviously is not meant to sound insensitive, but when we think about the number of threats, the fact that Kayla Mueller was taken by terrorists in what was basically a war zone, does that have to affect the U.S. approach? I mean, should it affect the approach even as we get past the fact that people are justifiably very sad about what happened?
Yeah, I think it does. I mean, you know, Americans have an extraordinary amount of freedom of travel around the world. There are very few places that they are officially denied the legal right to go to by the U.S. government. And even in those places, Americans often find ways to get there if they really want to. And in the Mueller's interview, I mean, they pointed out that they were not really sure where she was and what she was doing and probably could not have stopped her anyhow. And I'm sure this is a note that rings true for a lot of parents across our country about their children and what they're doing and choosing to endeavors they're choosing to be part of. It's a very difficult issue here, and I think another point they made that's a good counterpoint to that is that Americans are very insular about really understanding what's going on in different parts of the world that are potentially risky, dangerous, or just live by different ethics and codes. You know, this has always been a challenge for a fairly insular population that nonetheless has tremendous exposure via the number of Americans who are out and about all over the world. I dare say there's an American in the air at any given time in almost any airplane that's up in the air. I dare say there's Americans in every country in the world out there who are in some aspect or another of potentially risky situations. It's just part of the way things are these days.
So should we actually feel like people are somewhat lucky that this doesn't happen more often?
Well, on an existential basis, Steve, I think that's exactly right. I mean, we don't want to say to Americans, hey, the world's a scary, dark, dangerous place. Don't go anywhere. Stay right home and live in your cave. I don't think we want to say that. But on the other hand, recognize that, you know, it is risky in some places. It's different. Cultures are different. Approaches are different. Lifestyles are different. Laws are different. Behaviors are judged differently. So as you get more global and as people get more traveled, they need to be more aware of the differences they're going to face and the challenges they should be aware of when they go to different places.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix talking with Paul Kinsinger, professor of business intelligence at the Thunderbird School at ASU. He's also a former member of the U.S. intelligence community. So, Paul, going back to this policy of not paying ransom, not directly negotiating with terrorists, is it a policy that still makes practical sense and is better than the alternative, at least?
Well, it's I think it's a policy that no one is particularly proud of or strongly in favor of these days because there are so many murky situations out there. It's not just a diplomat or a military member of the U.S. military who's been grabbed and being held by a terrorist group, as it was a fairly black and white situation. In those situations, we now have educators, aid workers, journalists, people who are doing their jobs and in many cases are not affecting the outcome of the situation on the ground. They're just collateral bystanders in many ways who are being grabbed and being pulled into these kinds of conflicts. This is part of that asymmetrical conflict we have today that defines much of the global political instability as we see it. I think, certainly this is being rethought as we go along in Washington as to how should the U.S. government approach these things. Even if we had a policy of more flexible engagement around negotiating and so on and so forth with holders of people like this, however, there's still no guarantee that that would improve the chances of a safe return on their behalves. These are quite volatile situations. We've known in the past that they can often go wrong anyhow. I have no doubt the Jordanians worked for several weeks to try to free that pilot, and yet he was apparently killed probably weeks ahead of the film that was shown of him. So what went wrong there, and how was that not, how did that not come to a successful outcome when the Jordanians are right there and have much clearer access to these kind of people than we have, for example? These are very, very tricky situations, and I don't think we should ever expect that, we're going to improve markedly mm-hmm. the chances of success of getting a release.
And Paul, when it comes to deciding this kind of thing, and when it comes to hostage taking or whatnot, and dealing with these groups that are not necessarily associated with one particular country, is there a feeling, is there even less trust involved than there may have been during the Cold War? But at least during the Cold War, it seemed like each side had a lot to lose.
Yeah, no, exactly, Steve. That's a great point. Certainly you had these kinds of shadowy exchanges going on in the Cold War. Spies and counter-spies and agents would get caught and grabbed, and then they'd be traded in, midnight exchanges at the Berlin Wall and so on and so forth, the things movies and books were written about. Yeah, what you had at that in that situation was, a much more controlled situation at the time, because you had governments working on behalf of the parties on both sides, and there was a very intricate dance that had to take place, but it always did. And very few people ended up not being exchanged in one form or another. We didn't hear much about it because it was all done quietly. But that's a great point. And the challenge now is for a lot of these kinds of groups like ISIS, there's no recognized figure we have any contact with. They don't have an embassy in Washington. They don't even have a consulate that's being, they aren't even being represented by some legitimate government who's acting on their behalf. It's all a set of, cutouts and shadowy players who say, yeah, we can stand for them and so on and so forth. But who's got the ability to guarantee any of these things, as governments had during the Cold War?
Paul, finally, really briefly, I'm curious as to, again, going back to what Kayla Mueller's parents had to say, and they were in the White House talking to President Obama. Are there, because these are such sensitive issues, and dealing with a family obviously is going to be even more sensitive, are there different types of people in the White House or in the intelligence community who actually talk to the parents in a way that sort of tries to be encouraging, or are they sort of, this is how it looks, this is black and white?
This is a tremendously delicate challenge, and I'm sure there are people whose specialty, whose job it is to treat the families with as the humanity and intimacy that they deserve in these situations, no question. But I can also tell you that during the Reagan years, for example, we used to hear back at CIA headquarters how anguished the president would be after meeting with hostage families, and that it became a challenge for the White House to try to minimize, and this sounds cynical and caustic, but to try to minimize that emotional impact of hostage families paying visits to the president, President Reagan in this sense, because they could see visibly what impact it was having on him. And this is a president much admired by Americans for his toughness. This impact that, would start to make him feel emotionally that maybe much more needed to be done. And in the end, it's the president's job to be able to stand back and look at the larger interests of the entire country and everyone in it. And you can imagine how difficult that must be.
Paul Kinsinger is professor of business intelligence at the Thunderbird School at ASU, a former member of the U.S. intelligence community, as you just heard. Paul, thank you as always for the time.
You bet, Steve. Good talking to you.
Still to come on Here and Now, we'll look at the new Morrison-Cronkite poll of what Arizonans think the state's priorities should be. And then later on this hour, we'll find out how the Arizona Diamondbacks got a $1 billion television contract. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by Night of the Open Door at ASU, inviting you to discover the university with hundreds of science and art activities for all ages. February 28th, 4 to 9 p.m., Tempe Campus. Registration at opendoor.asu.edu.
You're listening to Here and Now on KJZZ. Well, a clear, sunny morning around the state right now. It's 49 degrees in Flagstaff, 52 in Prescott, 54 in Tucson, 68 in Yuma. Support for Here and Now is brought to you by April from Tempe and her donation of a Nissan Sentra. Find out how you can donate your vehicle by visiting cars.kjzz.org, and thanks. Sunny skies in the valley right now, and it's 61 degrees at KJZZ at 11:23.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. From time to time, there are efforts to figure out what Arizona's priorities should be, at least from the perspective of residents. Sometimes they sync up with what elected officials and business leaders want, and sometimes they don't. The Morrison Institute of Public Policy at ASU has released its inaugural Morrison-Cronkite quarterly poll. It surveyed 754 Arizona adults to find out their preferences. Joining me with more details is David Doherty, Morrison's associate director and the poll's director. David, thanks for being here.
Sure. Thank you, Steve.
So how did you come to figure out how to ask the questions, in particular with K-12 education? I think that's an interesting approach.
Yeah, we've done a fair number of polls, and I, in my career, have done a fair number. So we have, designing polls is a relatively simple task for us since we've done so much of it. What we had to do really to set up the poll was try to make some kind of a determination about what were the issues we wanted to test, what was the list. And in retrospect, like every time you do research, in retrospect, there are a couple I left off that I would add now. One is gun rights. Okay. The other is immigration issues, both of which the legislature deals with on a regular basis. So, but it's a matter of sitting down with my colleagues and us figuring out what we ought to be asking.
So K-12 education, water, major priorities for the respondents.
They're the top two. Okay. Neither was a surprise. We've done questions on education before. State residents are incredibly interested in education. They tend to be interested in anything related to kids, whether it's young kids or kids in high school. It's when you bring that up, they're always interested in programs that help them. So it didn't surprise us.
Now, water can be such a complicated issue because you ask anyone in the desert, of course we need water. How in-depth could you get with that question in terms of what's related to water and what people really know about what we need going into the future?
Well, with water, we just recently opened the Kyle Water Center at Morrison, and so that's become a higher priority for us. What we're really trying to find out is how people feel, whether they believe we're in a water crisis, whether they believe conservation, less use of water is enough to help us. And we're just trying to find out what their mindset was. Because water, as you say, is a very complicated issue, and it's the nuances of it are myriad.
Coming back to K-12 education, I thought your approach to the Common Core question, that term itself has become so controversial, I thought it was interesting the way you decided to sort of divide that question up.
Right. What we wanted to do was we wanted to find out if reactions to what is essentially the purpose of the Common Core standards compared with the phrase Common Core, how they were sort of tied together. So what we did is we divided the sample into two separate groups. One group we asked, do you favor or disapprove the state adopting the Common Core standards using the phrase Common Core? The other half we said, we described the basic elements of the Common Core and said, would you be willing to adopt that for the state? And the differences were what we predicted. The Common Core is politicized. So something like 55% disapproved of Common Core, something like 70% approved of the elements of Common Core when they were described that way without the phrase Common Core.
You mentioned politicized, and that begs the question for me related to actually break down the poll in terms of how Democrats respond, Republicans, and independents. What does that give you? What sort of insight does that provide?
Well, it it lets us know really, and we can break it down by age, we can break it down by sex, we can break it down by geographic location in the state. The biggest differences we saw when we reviewed the data was between the political parties, or between the folks who attach themselves to particular political parties. And that's the reason we reported it out that way. It's where the differences lie. And it was, you could have pretty well predicted the direction it went. The folks on the Republican side tend to respond more positively toward fiscally conservative issues. The folks on the Democratic side tend to respond more positively toward what I consider social issues. And it's pretty much what you would predict.
So, David, when a poll like this comes out, and I know it's the first Morrison-Cronkite poll, but there are certain surveys about what Arizonans want that's been in the past. How do you make something like this move the needle, or at least raise awareness of what people are talking about?
Well, one of the ways is to get coverage from folks like you. Our goal is really to inform the public and to inform decision makers about what the public is thinking. Now, sometimes that may not influence the decision making, and I understand that. For example, prisons were rated the lowest priority among the folks we interviewed. That said, prisons require about $1 billion a year, and whether the general public wants to prioritize it low or not, it's going to take that much money to maintain the prison system. So what we're trying to do is to inform not only everyone's fellow citizens, but try to inform decision makers about what's on the minds of the electorate. Mm-hmm. And, you know, education consistently jumps to the top. Almost every politician will tell you education's high on their agenda, and I'm sure they're right, and I believe them. That said, the folks that live in this state are not happy with their K-12 education system.
David, finally, this will be a quarterly poll, as we mentioned. So what changes from quarter to quarter? Will you sort of keep most of the same questions to see if anything changes? Will you change them up?
No, I would guess anything we track, that is, that we ask numerous times, we'll probably do once a year. Okay. So we won't track the same questions every quarter. And we're really open to doing polls maybe where we just talk to women if we want to talk about women's issues, or we just talk to business people if we're looking at business issues. So we're really open to the kinds of ways we'll use the poll. Our goal really is to provide feedback to the state about what's on people's minds. So it depends on what's an important issue at that time.
Interesting. David Dougherty is Associate Director of the Morrison Institute at ASU and the Director of the new quarterly poll for Morrison and the Walter Cronkite School. David, thanks.
Great. Thank you.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Progress in U.S. civil rights and the continuing challenges are in the news nearly every day, from the U.S. Supreme Court taking up the issue of same-sex marriage, to events in Ferguson, Missouri, to the prominent release of the film Selma. Mary Frances Berry, who formerly was chair of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, will be speaking about some of those and related topics tonight at 7 at ASU's Tempe campus. She's giving the Rhodes Lecture presented by Barrett, the Honors College, and she joins me now. Dr. Berry, what does progress on civil rights look like to you in a concrete way? And as a follow-up to that, is the goal of a colorblind society a reasonable one, a reachable one?
It's not even desirable to have a colorblind society. We don't have one, and we're unlikely to have one, because if we had a colorblind society, it would mean that we didn't even acknowledge some very important characteristics of people when we encounter and meet them. It's not what color people are, it's the consequences. We don't want bad consequences related to color. And in the first place, first part of your question, what civil rights progress looks like is when we believe that people who, as Bill Clinton used to say, work hard and play by the rules, and by that I mean people who work, who go to school, who try to accomplish things, and who deal honestly with their fellow men and women, have an opportunity in society to go as far as their minds can take them without being constrained by who they are or what color they are or what language they speak or what background they have. And I think we will then have, liberty and justice for all if we can ever reach that goal.
To what extent have we seen true progress on that front?
Well, we're commemorating the 50th anniversary of all kinds of landmarks in this country, including the great Civil Rights Acts and the movement. And it's clear that we've made enormous progress. We have people who have jobs and opportunities that they would never have had before. People who have the right to vote who wouldn't have been able to without the changes that took place. I mean, everywhere, and we have a president of the United States who is a man of color. And so everywhere you look, you can see enormous change. Our problem is that change seems to be stagnated in certain areas, in particular in the area of the economy. In fact, the black unemployment rate is higher than it was in, at the time that the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was passed. And it has been twice the rate of whites in this country for the entire Obama presidency. In fact, the only time it's not been twice as high was in about, you know, one in the 90s when we had the tech bubble. For a couple of years there. So when you look at the economic front and look at the asset gap, the Urban Institute just did a report the other day on how the assets that blacks own and Latinos own are so minimal compared to the assets that whites have and who can pass along assets to their children and can build wealth. The criminal justice system. We get all of these highly publicized events that take place here in Arizona and New Mexico, out in Washington State, all over the country, Ferguson, New York City, mm-hmm. where there are issues with police and community, some of which seem to be related to racial profiling of people just because of who they are. So we have to, and we've been dealing with these issues for my entire lifetime. But I have a theory about civil rights progress, and that is, Steve, that you make progress by going forward a little bit. You may fall back some, but not all the way back, and then you go forward a little bit again, and you just keep getting it done incrementally, and you get more and more people committed to it, and you keep moving despite the setbacks, and that's how you make change.
So these high-profile incidents, as you said, Arizona has seen, Ferguson, Missouri, New York City, they've received so much attention that it makes some people, especially those who really want to see great progress, feel that some of the problems and the challenges are actually getting worse. Do you feel that way when you see this, but then realize in the bigger picture maybe that doesn't mean as much as it does on a day-to-day basis?
Well, it doesn't mean as much as it would have if it were happening 50 years ago, because 50 years ago it happened more often, and in fact it indicated there was very little change. There are police departments that have tried to improve in this country. Some have. We cite examples. The L.A. Police Department, which I investigated when I was chair of the Civil Rights Commission several times. And they abided by the recommendations that were made, and they've improved. And so when they have those episodes, they seem to be able to take care of them better. There are other places where they've not made the kind of improvement. One of the main things we need for the police community issues is civilian review boards that work. Review boards on which people, citizens, are able to, and people, individuals in the community, are able to review what has gone on and make recommendations about change. Many police officers who are we rely on to keep us safe tell me in hearings that I've held that their big problem is they don't have the training, adequate training, to know how to deal with these episodes, and that they're most of the time afraid. And they react to something without thinking it through very carefully. That's a question of training and a question of selection. So there's improvement in a lot of these areas, and when some big episode happens, something that's highly publicized, that doesn't mean there hasn't been any change. It just means that we're in danger of losing the progress we've made.
I suppose we can get caught up sometimes in the hyperbole, but I do wonder from a general standpoint, who can or who should the public trust when it comes to some issues related to law enforcement? Because it seems like multiple sides often try to generate the political advantage rather than at least on its face approach the challenges honestly.
I think it depends on who you listen to. If you listen to one side or the other, then you can come away with a viewpoint that may be totally inadequate. You should listen to all sides of all issues. That's what I do. And I remember when we had the hearings, and they're published in a big report on police practices and civil rights that the commission published, which is free online. After a horrendous murder in New York City of a guy named Amadou Diallo, who was shot many times by the police, that you listen to the police, and when talking to them quietly, not when someone is on television trying to make a point or on the radio trying to make a point for one side or the other, and they tell you what I said about being afraid, about the training, about what they need and what should happen. And if you listen to ordinary people talk about it, they will admit to you, yes, we need the police. We want them. I've just been in New Orleans for the last month or so, and there are big signs all over the neighborhoods saying, we want more police. We like police. We just don't have enough of them because there's been a lot of crime, and people are worried about crime. So I think that you need to be able to hear many voices on these issues and not just one side or the other.
What do you think of the advancement on same-sex marriage? And I know that, though this has been a long-standing effort for people really involved in that, for the general public who hasn't been involved in it, it seems like significant progress was made in a very short time. Is that ultimately how movements related to civil rights have to work?
Well, the advantage that the LGBT movement, the LGBTQ movement, has had is that many of the people who are gay are white, and they have power in the society, so that has helped because there's money. I mean, if you, there are campaign funds, and there are all kinds of things, and other people have mobilized their money. They have to mobilize their bodies, the other people do, in the causes that they're in, whether it's immigration and immigration reform, of whether it is the rights of African Americans or Black Lives Matter or whoever's lives are at stake matters. When you aren't able to amass that and you're not the power inside, there are many people who are gay who have been in high positions of authority. But I think, yes, there was a movement. The movement has been going on for a long, long time. It hasn't had to do the kinds of going to jail and dying, although there are a few people who have died because they're gay, that the civil rights movement had to undergo. But I think it was time for it. It fooled me, though, in a sense. I always said that it might take longer for the for gay rights to come into existence because of all the approximations of religion and sin and all that sort of stuff. But I was wrong about it primarily because of the racial component. My disappointment with the movement, I'm glad that the same-sex marriage campaign seems to be taking the country by a storm, and I expect the Supreme Court to decide that it's legal everywhere. I'm unhappy because they haven't focused enough on employment discrimination. Lots of people who are gay, they can't get jobs or they get fired from jobs, and I think employment non-discrimination is as important as the other issues. My other gripe about it is that the movement doesn't pay enough attention to people who are gay and something else. So I hope that once same-sex marriage is a matter of reality everywhere, we can move on to those issues.
Mary Frances Berry, who formerly was chair of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, she'll be speaking about civil rights tonight at 7 at ASU's Tempe campus. She's giving the Rhodes Lecture presented by Barrett, the Honors College. Dr. Berry, thanks for the time.
Okay, thanks, Steve.
Still to come on Here and Now, we'll find out how the Arizona Diamondbacks, even with Major League Baseball's worst record, managed to sign a $1 billion local TV contract. And then later on, we'll talk to Arizona's official state balladeer, Dolan Ellis. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by SRP, providing over 150 education grants last year to schools in our community, creating a foundation for future scientists, engineers, technicians, and tradespeople. More at srp4edu.com.
Good morning. It's KJZZ's Here and Now. Well, we've got some chance for some rain this weekend, but things should be dry for the next few days. You'll have some time to get out and cut that grass. Sunshine today with highs in the mid-70s tomorrow as well. It's 61 degrees right now in Phoenix. Checking Valley traffic on the 202 Red Mountain Freeway eastbound. Watch out for a crash blocking the exit ramp at Priest. It's 11:41 at KJZZ.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. The Arizona Diamondbacks, who had the worst record in Major League Baseball in 2014 and are expected to continue down that path in the 2015 season, have agreed to a new television contract with Fox Sports. Unofficial reports show the organization signing a 20-year deal worth at least $1.5 billion, again, for a last-place team that is not in one of the top 10 TV markets. But the Diamondbacks are not the only team that has agreed to a massive contract extension locally. With me for a few minutes to talk about that trend is writer Wendy Thurm, who focuses on baseball and sports business, and you can follow her on Twitter at Hanging Sliders. Wendy, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
So where is all this money coming from?
Well, it's coming from two places. And the first one is driven by the fact that baseball is immensely popular in local markets, even for teams like the Diamondbacks that haven't had particularly good records in the last several years. As your listeners probably know, your network TV series essentially go on hiatus or into reruns over the summer, and that results in local baseball games being having super high ratings, you know, in the local market, as compared to nationally broadcast games, where there's been a lot of hand-wringing lately over what, you know, perceived as kind of dropping national ratings, especially for marquee games like the All-Star Game and the postseason. So the viewers are there. The viewers are asking by turning on the TVs. They're showing that they're interested. And the regional sports networks, in this case in Arizona, it's Fox Sports Arizona, they recoup the money they pay out to the teams in two ways. Mm. One is with advertising. And, of course, the higher their ratings, the more they can charge advertisers to participate in their game broadcast and the pre- and post-game and any other team-related content they provide. And the second way is by charging what's called a carriage fee, which is the amount that the regional sports network charges the cable and satellite companies to carry their network. I'm not familiar with who the big providers are in the Phoenix area, but whoever that is, they'll have to pay, you know, two, three, four, I don't know what the number is, but some number per subscriber in order to offer that channel to their local subscribers. Now, that's gotten some regional sports networks into trouble, and we can talk about that.
Well, San Diego came to mind for me, and a lot of people who are in Phoenix go to San Diego for the summer, and was it the year before last they couldn't see any Padres games, I think, right?
Right. There were two seasons where the Padres were shown in only, I think, 40% of households kind of in the capture area because the local regional sports network, which I also think was Fox Network, Fox Sports San Diego, couldn't come to agreement with several of the cable and satellite operators over this carriage fee. And so several of the operators said, well, we're not going to pay you $2, $3, $3.50 per subscriber. We're just not going to carry you. And this is a dance that's increasingly being played out. On the biggest stage, it's happening in Los Angeles with the Dodgers.
So Diamondbacks president Derek Hall had brought up the idea, and you mentioned the regional network, this kind of thing, and it's, we think about the Yankees with the YES Network. You mentioned the Dodgers. Is it viable at all for a team, again, in a market like this size, to decide to start its own network? There have got to be really built-in pitfalls, and the Diamondbacks must have seen that in their crystal ball.
Yeah, the trend in general is away from team-owned networks. The Yankees actually have divested themselves of majority ownership in the YES Network. Mm-hmm. It's now owned majority by Fox Sports. Mm-hmm. And the Dodgers, you know, while they co-own the new sports network LA with Time Warner, in fact, took all of the risk of being able to negotiate this carriage fee. So the Dodgers, and they haven't been able to do that. So the Dodgers are only seen in the Los Angeles area, in fact, in the entire area that covers the Dodgers broadcast market. They're only seen on something like 20 to 30% of household televisions because obviously Time Warner carries its own network. It's DirecTV which has made big inroads in the LA area, that has refused, you know, to come to agreement, not refused to come to agreement. They just haven't reached agreement with Sportsnet LA on a number. And this is a strategy we've seen play out by DirecTV and other markets. It happened with the Houston Astros as well. And in fact, that stalled negotiation forced that regional sports network, which was originally known as Comcast Sportsnet Houston, that entity was forced into bankruptcy because the economics weren't working without having a certain number of cable and satellite companies on board. So, you know, there are risks on both sides. Mm-hmm. I was a little surprised. I'm a little surprised every time there's one of these deals, particularly in a market like Arizona or a smaller market. You know, I am surprised because I'm one of those people who thinks maybe the bubble isn't going to burst like a loud balloon, but there's kind of a slow hissing sound just out of this entire structure in general, right? I mean, younger people are either not having a cord to begin with or are cutting the cord. There are more ways to stream content there's no pure a la carte system yet for cable and satellite companies, but if you want to watch only certain kinds of shows and certain kinds of sports, you can kind of cobble together a streaming system that will cost you significantly less than a one-size-fits-all cable or satellite bill.
Right, and Wendy, briefly, I just wanted to jump in briefly on that, Wendy. We only have a few seconds left. How does that affect the demographics of baseball, which the sport is already concerned about getting older, and if you have the older audience that still is tied to the cable and the younger audience that is not, could that be a bigger risk as well for demographics for a TV network?
Well, the big issue there is the question of local blackouts. Mm. So right now, if you are in the Phoenix area and you have, you know, theoretically access to Fox Sports Arizona, you can't watch Diamondbacks games, whether they're home or away games, either through an app on your phone or MLB. They have their MLB TV app, and they also have MLB Extra Innings, which is an extra package. You know, you can purchase on your cable or satellite. You can't watch home games on those because we have what are called local blackouts to protect the regional sports networks. You know, essential monopoly in that market. I mean, if they weren't protected, they wouldn't pay this big money, right?
Right.
But baseball recognizes this is a problem, and so there are efforts underway to allow folks who already pay for the cable or satellite to be able to then put in a password and watch a game, you know, if they're at a friend's house or at work or wherever, right? They already paid for it. They shouldn't have to pay for it twice.
Yeah,
and then to try and figure out a way to capture additional income by streaming, right? Some people aren't going to sign up for cable or satellite, but they will stream. And so trying to fit that kind of system within these larger deals, which for the most part were negotiated, you know, under the kind of the old regime, that's a big challenge, and baseball knows that.
Writer Wendy Thurm, she focuses on baseball and sports business. A really interesting follow on Twitter at Hanging Sliders. Wendy, thank you for the time.
Thanks, Steve. Take care.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. We close today's program by marking Arizona Statehood Month. It turned 103 on February 14th. Official state balladeer Dolan Ellis and longtime journalist Sam Lowe have collaborated on a new book and CD project called Arizona, Lens, Lyric, and Lore. They'll be signing the book, and Ellis will be performing tonight at 7 at the Burton Barr Library in Phoenix. And they're with me now for a preview. Welcome to you both. Thanks for being here.
It's great to be here.
Thank you.
Dolan, I'm going to start with you on this. You are the official balladeer of Arizona and have been for a long time. What first brought you to the state, and what made you stay here? What increased your affection?
Actually, what brought me to the state were my childhood heroes. It was Roy Rogers, Gene Autry, all those guys. Remember, maybe you don't remember, but I remember they used to ride through the saguaro cactus with their white hats on and put down the bad guys. And I guess I kind of bonded with the Sonoran Desert at that time. I couldn't wait to get here. I came here right after I got out of school.
And what kept you here? I mean, obviously, you are associated with Arizona. People think of Arizona history, they often think of you and Marshall Trimble together.
I knew before I got here that this is where I wanted to be. I've always known that since preschool. I've always known that I belonged in Arizona. So go figure.
Now, where did you come from?
Kansas.
Okay.
I was a farm kid in Kansas. My folks had a 640-acre farm there, and so I grew up wandering that farm and the creeks and the back roads. I had a real Huck Finn sort of beginning in life, and I think that nurtured my love for the outdoors. Even as a young kid, my window to the wider world as a farm boy was National Geographic magazine. And the Sonoran Desert is featured quite often in National Geographic with its unique animals and unique plants and all of that. So I became very familiar with Arizona as a small boy on that Kansas farm.
And Sam Lowe, longtime Arizona journalist, what brought you to Arizona?
On May 19th, 1969, I was standing in my front yard in a house I had just built in Jamestown, North Dakota, and I was shoveling snow, and it was May 19th. I threw the shovel down, walked in the house, and said, "I'm leaving." And they all said, "Yeah, we've heard that before." But by the next September, I was in Arizona.
Okay, but why was it Arizona? I mean, you could say I could have gone to California, could have gone to New Mexico. Why Arizona?
I wrote letters to every newspaper in Arizona, New Mexico, Utah, and Colorado seeking employment, and the only letters I got back were from Phoenix and Scottsdale. So I took one of those jobs and went to work for the Scottsdale Progress.
What stood out to you? Did you know much about it?
Yeah, I didn't read National Geographic. Well, I read National Geographic under the covers at night, but Arizona Highways was the main reason. I was offered a job once in Rapid City, South Dakota, and it was really a good job offer, but he had a copy of Arizona Highways laying on his desk, and I knew that if I took that job, I would spend the rest of my life regretting not moving to Arizona. So that was the major reason.
So other than work, which is a major reason, but other than the work, what has kept you here then?
The outdoors. I love the desert. I'm getting to a point where summers are getting a little long, but I really love the winter times. I love the spring. I love the autumn. And the summer I can tolerate. Mm-hmm. So it's the outdoors, it's the availabilities, it's the opportunities, it's the wonderful panoramas of Canyon de Chelly, the Grand Canyon, Monument Valley. These things keep me here.
Now, how did you two end up meeting?
We were standing on a street corner in Scottsdale one February afternoon, and we got involved in a shootout with each other. They gave us guns and cowboy hats. Well, Dolan had his own hat. And there were all these people standing around, so we stood out there in the middle of the street, didn't know each other at the time, and we were supposed to shoot at each other. Well, we drew and fired, and we didn't hit anybody because there were blanks in the guns. And the interesting thing was, the people in the audience had been forewarned about what was going to happen. They all fell down, but Dolan and I didn't fall down. So we became good friends after that.
So when you draw guns on each other, Dolan, that's what brings friendship around?
Well, I guess so.
Most people would say it'd be the other way around. I'm confused.
I guess so. That was a lot of fun. Back in those days, rodeo and that Scottsdale rodeo and all of that, I mean, they'd even let the school out for rodeo.
Now, Sam, both of you tell a lot of stories, not just in the book, but in general about living in Arizona. How many of them are true?
Oh, well, now I suppose we have to say some. We have both found that truth is really good. Like, one of the stories in the book is the bombing of Knockle, Arizona, which was an historical truth. It's grown a little bit in legend, but the basic truth is that Naco, Arizona, in 1926, I think, got bombed by a couple of rebel Americans.
Wow.
It was an accident. They were trying to bomb Naco, Sonora, and their aim was a little off.
How did you decide, as a team, what stories were going to make it in, what songs were going to make it in?
It was just a collaborative effort. We talked about all the things we knew. Well, not all the things we knew, but we talked about a lot of things and which were our favorites. And a lot of it depended on the songs that Dolan had. Mm. And so we kind of built the book around that.
I think that we couldn't have done a song that that I felt was a really strong song, but maybe Sam didn't have the story to go with it, and other way around, if he had a really strong story that I didn't have a good song to go with, we couldn't do that.
Now, Ghost Town, some people are familiar with, they might think of Jerome. What did you write about Ghost Towns?
The ones we write about are not, they're no longer towns, they're ghost towns. You go there and the old tin signs are creaking in the wind. You walk into a building and the floors squeak and creak, and you hear sounds that you really think are ghostly. There are 250 of them in Arizona, and most of them were mining towns where the people came trying to eke out a living from the earth. Some of them became boom towns. Some of them made people wealthy. Most of them, the mines dried up, and the people packed up their pixes and moved on. So those are the kind we're discussing here, not the artsy centers that the Jerome has become.
Okay. And now Dolan Ellis with Little One Ghost Town.
And that desert sun beat down on that little one ghost town. Oh. Summer's day, while on my way through the Santan Mountain Range, hiking through a canyon all alone, I heard the call of the crumbled walls of a tumble-down miner's claim, coming from beneath a pile of stone. Well, I went into the town to have a look around and investigate the sound that I had heard. Well, the only thing I found were some bones upon the ground and a lizard running round that I disturbed. And that desert sun beat down on that little one ghost town. Oh.
Official state balladeer Dolan Ellis and writer Sam Lowe. They've collaborated on a new book and CD project called Arizona, Lens, Lyric, and Lore. You can see them tonight at 7 at the Burton Bar Library in Phoenix.
Standing and looking out at me from a knothole crack behind my back, I felt an icy stare from the spirit of this town that used to be. Well, I hope he didn't mind if I spent a little time searching for a story to be told. What treasures did he find? Was the ore still in the mine? Did he leave behind?
And that's all for today's edition of KJZZ's Here and Now. Thanks very much to Senior Producer Sarah Ventry and Bruce Drummond for their help on today's program. Thank you very much for listening. If you missed any parts of the program or want to hear a previous segment again, you can go online later this afternoon to kjzz.org. You can also download the KJZZ app to your smartphone. NPR's Here and Now is next on listener-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. I'm Steve Goldstein. Have a great rest of the day. It's 12 o'clock.
KJZZ is supported by Arizona Opera. The Magic Flute comes to Symphony Hall in a new production inspired by steampunk and Rene Magritte. Girl meets boy, boy meets snake.